Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines. This is your weekly Friday morning Utah news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, abortion is still legal in Utah after a judge blocked the state's trigger law from taking effect. Utah doctors try to figure out why some kids get diabetes after contracting COVID-19. Salt Lake City's widespread gentrification has all but wiped out affordable neighborhoods citywide. And the latest in Utah food and alcohol news, from Cornish pasties to new bar licenses. Joining me for this conversation on the Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. And good morning, Courtney. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Roger.
Also joining us is Tribune real estate reporter Tony Semerad. And Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. And then later on the show, we will hear from reporters Becky Jacobs and Stephanie Russell. Stay tuned for that. A quick note to KCPW listeners who are hopefully joining us on our online stream. We are working on our signal problem. Thank you very much for your patience. And you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We can't take your phone calls this morning, but we can reply in the Twitter sphere. And where I want to start today is with gentrification and its discontents. Tony Semerad, you wrote about a new study that was released, a study that I believe was commissioned by Salt Lake City to look at displacement, affordability, and housing. It has some pretty astounding findings in terms of the impacts of gentrification on Utah's capital city. What are the bullet points here, Tony? This is about growth, development, and decreasing affordability.
Yeah, it really is. So this study has been in the works since November, and this, to be clear, is sort of the phase one initial finding of what's really been a kind of an unprecedented outreach effort. They've talked to 2,000 or more residents and in very kind of nuanced ways to get their stories. And this has been combined with a kind of a mapping analysis from a think tank in Berkeley that studies this full time, the Urban Displacement Project, that kind of looks at the metrics of income and eviction and this and population data and that sort of thing. Yeah. And as you say, the picture is very stark. They're saying there's essentially no affordable neighborhoods for people that are being displaced to move. These are primarily renters in Salt Lake City. That's been the study's focus. And you know, more than half of residents are spending enough of their income to be considered cost burdened. And that's put them kind of on the edge of all of this rapid growth and development. And so, you know, what's kind of astonishing is we're seeing this displacement. And you know, to back up, the study really encompasses a lot of the surrounding municipal areas and really takes in the whole state in that regard in terms of where people might land. And they're really, you know, given the hemmed in geography of the valley, there really is no place for those to land that are displaced, that are kind of in those moderate income, you know, groups. And so this is falling heaviest on our diversity in the city. These are, you know, this is affecting more than half of white households, but much higher numbers for Black and Latinx and you know, some of the minority groups that, you know, the city administration considers essential to the city, you know.
Tony, just a couple of points here. I want to define terms. I mean, when we talk about gentrification, this means gentrification sort of generally is new affluence moving into a community and thereby forcing out through pricing the long-term residents of that place, more or less. I mean, that's, right. Yeah.
Right. And maybe another way to think about it is displacement and the precarious measures of how, you know, precarity of how vulnerable people are to having to move right now.
You've got a I mean, there's an amazing quote from one of the study's authors that you drew on here, and it's every single area in Salt Lake City, unfortunately, that is affordable is experiencing displacement. That means when low-income households are displaced, there is nowhere for them to go. That's Tim Thomas with the Urban Displacement Project. Again, as you said, based at the University of California, Berkeley, who's one of the authors, again, of that study. And he and his fellow experts, they wrote in this report that they had never seen a situation quite like this.
Yeah, and to be clear, there's two pieces unique to Utah in that statement that, you know, we have this sort of bowl effect, you know, with between the Oakers and the Wasatch that are really limiting the urban area. And so when that balloon bulges out, it doesn't have the sort of suburbs that other areas, you know, big cities might have where, you know, people can move further out, you know, and so that's a big part of it. But the other is this sort of steep trajectory of growth for Utah that, you know, as we know from the census data, was the, you know, among the fastest growing states over the last 10 years. And that sort of accelerated in the pandemic window. So it's the combination of that and, you know, we're going into this as a lot of cities are with just a basic deficit in affordable housing because of this lag in building that we've seen over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, the geography makes that unique, but yes, indeed, that was a very stark statement that they had never seen anything like this, yeah, you know, before. And these are affecting, you know, neighborhoods around Salt Lake City and environments, which was sort of surprising to me. There's, you know, well-documented gentrification going on the East Bench, you know, and some of the neighborhoods that we traditionally think of as mostly single family homes. Again, this study is focused mostly on renters.
Yeah.
And this is sort of going into a broader policy kind of analysis that's been going on for at City Hall in terms of how to address this. And they hope to be talking about some policy solutions by September.
Yeah. You point out that there's a couple of things. I mean, one is that, people who, as you said, people who are already in home, people who already own homes, that is, who are homeowners, they're kind of, insulated. Obviously, they're less impacted by gentrification in general because they're not getting forced out of their living situation because they can't afford to pay rent.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I mean, it is true that given that focus on renters and analyzing the displacement sort of in that group of residents, you know, single family homeowners may not be affected by some of that, but they are most certainly seeing very dramatic change in their neighborhoods with regard to the sort of shift to more of a rental mix in the city's housing stock and all of the sort of changes in neighborhoods that brings with it. But the, you know, the story points out also that even homeowners are worried about the next generation. And in so many situations, we have families doubled up or tripled up, you know, in homes because the younger generation can't afford the down payment. And you know, with the interest rate picture changing, that's getting even more dramatic what that generation faces.
Yeah.
So it there's really nobody that's insulated from this if you live in Salt Lake City.
There's a couple of, I mean, some interesting stats from the report. Are that 1 in 5 residents who spoke to researchers said that they had moved or had to move due to rising rents, and 13% said they were about to do so. 40% said they knew somebody who had been forced to move out of the city due to financial or development pressures. And then it says that 50% of renters in Salt Lake City are now considered cost burdened, and this has to do with the percentage of your paycheck that you spend on rent. Can you explain what cost burdened means, Tony?
Yeah, this is a kind of a standard scale that a lot of people that look at housing use, and it has to do with the portion of your income that you are spending toward you know, housing. And when I first got into this, 25 was considered a comfortable threshold. Now that's 30, and people are, you know, most people are paying way more than that if they're living in the metropolitan area. And you know, as some of the elected leaders had noted, there's also sort of a cost of living factor if you're taking on a long commute with fuel prices right now. So there's sort of a trade-off there if you're moving further out. But yeah, more than half are cost burdened. And of course that skews, you know, there's a sort of a low income picture there where housing is very, very deeply unavailable. You know, if you're making say 50% or below of the median wage,
right? Sorry to cut you off. If you spend a third of your income or more on your rent, that's
considered cost burden. Yeah.
Um,
yeah, yeah,
you know, and you pointed out that there's this overlay that touches on the city's and America's history with racist housing policies, meaning historic redlining. You write that the city under Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall has a goal of keeping existing residents in place as much as possible. I mean, they are the ones who commissioned this report. The goal of keeping people where they are as much as possible, that sounds aspirational. But by what mechanisms, Tony? How is that? What are they doing to that end?
Well, that's part of the way the city got into this. This has been cast as a sort of an anti-gentrification and displacement sort of exploration, and they've waited to understand much better what's going on the ground before trying to craft what these policies are, which isn't to say that they aren't working on those, but, you know, before putting the final stamp on what they want to do. And for the immediate concern is that the city doesn't really have a policy with regard to replacing housing that is lost, or, you know, sort of mitigating the loss of housing, affordable housing in the city when new housing is built. And we have so many examples of where, you know, aging single family homes, clusters of them around town, are being, you know, sort of rezoned and then demolished for new multifamily housing coming in. And that tends to be at a higher income level, you know, those rentals. And so the city really doesn't have a one-for-one policy for addressing how that housing is displaced. So figuring that out first is one thing. And, you know, because so much of this has to do with escalating rents, the study, this sort of initial phase one, is recommending rental assistance. And that, particularly in the pandemic window, is something the city's done. And will it do more of that? There are recommendations that have to do with a living wage, which is a common tool in other states and other cities for these kinds of problems. That's in some ways preempted by the Utah legislature in Utah. In some ways, state law,
right,
you know, doesn't allow cities to kind of get into that business. But there's also this notion that the city could know what better to press for on Capitol Hill if it identifies these as tools. And maybe there's room for change at the state level with regard to what cities can do on wages. But rental assistance is another example of what they proposed.
And that's money that they have doled out, as you said, during the pandemic. You mentioned this pandemic window when the city has been offering rental assistance. I mean, I think that there are rental assistance programs. Are there actually, no, Tony, this is a question for you. Are there permanent rental assistance programs from Salt Lake City? And, you know,
permanent's a relative term when you're talking city council budgeting, sure. You know what I mean? And so there are considerable resources stepped up for that now, and how they continue and how they dovetail with what other levels of government do. That's sort of an ongoing wrangle, if you will. But yeah, there are some permanent sources of money for helping residents as they move in, you know, in the tens of millions in terms of rental assistance. But you know, what's interesting about that too, coming back to the central point of all of this, is that this measure of gentrification and displacement has been based on 2015 to 2019 data, and that unfortunately has to do with ways in which the latest census is considered flawed and considered an undercount, and then not getting at the actual picture for other complicated political reasons.
Right.
And so with a picture like that, you have to assume that's what happened since has probably worsened a lot of these effects. So for however alarming this initial round of findings might seem, there's reasons to think it's gotten worse in the last 2 years.
Wow.
And we have only to look at the housing, you know, the homeless encampments around the city, and that very complicated problem that's swelling and worsening in the city, as maybe an example of where all of this is headed in those 2 years. And so there's an urgency here now in City Hall with these initial findings, and it'll be really fascinating to see where all this heads.
Yeah, and what kind of action gets taken as a result? I mean, you mentioned some of the extant solutions or efforts, I guess. Solutions is kind of a hard line to put in there because it's such an enormous problem. And so, yeah, how do you know the fact that things might be quite a bit worse in terms of displacement? We barely scratched the surface on that connection to homelessness, which is obviously significant. Tony, it's really fascinating reporting. Anything else you would have listeners know about it before we head to a break and let you go? I mean, you have a link to the report itself in your article, which is worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing to note here is that, you know, the city's heading into a six-month, year-long period of a really deep discussion about what it's doing on housing. And there are a lot of opportunities for people that care about this to get involved. And we've seen a lot of advocates for renters, for example, get involved in the process over the last two or three years. And a lot of, you know, established homeowners in a lot of these neighborhoods through the community council system. And, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for engagement coming up here and input in terms of where residents think this should go. And so this is a phase one. This is a real, you know, important snapshot. And this phase two is just as important in terms of debating and figuring out what we do, you know. So there's a lot of opportunity for the public still here.
Okay. That is Tony Semirad, real estate reporter with Salt Lake Tribune. It's just a really eye-opening article and report. You can find it over at sltrib.com. With that, we are going to head to our first break in the show. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. More to come. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Courtney Tanner and Tony Semirad. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW. You know, I want to turn now to a story that was not on my radar, actually, until I saw Courtney Tanner's reporting on this. And Courtney, it's that some Utah doctors are trying to determine why it is that some kids, after getting COVID-19, then get diabetes. And the belief is that some kids, that is, the virus is actually triggering both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, right? We don't know how that's happening, but how do we know that it is happening?
Right. It is this kind of medical mystery, the latest in these kind of longer haul issues that people have been having after COVID-19. And with this case, what we know is that Primary Children's Hospital here in Utah has seen a pretty sizable spike in kids developing both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, you know, more than an average year. And doctors are connecting it to COVID. You know, these kids are coming in a week or a month after having COVID and then showing symptoms of diabetes. So right now there's this, you know, correlation and federal studies from like the CDC are noting it as well.
Wow. I mean, we should say that this is a lifelong illness, meaning the virus might come and go, but diabetes stays with you forever. And other viruses have been known to trigger, you know, certain kinds of diabetes, especially type 1 diabetes, but this is triggering both type 1 and type 2. I think, you know, people who don't have to deal with it vaguely understand what diabetes is. It's an issue with blood sugar, having high blood sugar because a person's body maybe isn't producing enough insulin. That's a hormone that helps you make the sugars from food usable in your cells. Untreated, it can cause very serious health problems. You have a doctor that you spoke with for this article, Courtney, who says that from what they've seen, there's a 20% uptick in cases during the pandemic in diabetes in kids.
That's right. Yeah. And noteworthy that it is both type 1 and type 2. You know, type 1 is generally thought of as, you know, genetic, but it's also autoimmune. So, you know, there have been cases where a virus triggers this. They're not really sure, you know, the mechanism that's doing it with COVID, but it's also triggering type 2, which is not autoimmune, which is generally associated and not always, but generally with, you know, not exercising or not eating healthy. But yeah, the virus is triggering both of these, and doctors are really honestly puzzled as to why.
You know, you have some stories of specific children in your article, and I'm wondering if you can tell us just maybe tell us the story of 2-year-old Addie and her experience and how it relates to this.
Yeah, this was you know, it's a really honestly, it's heartbreaking. You know, this 2-year-old little girl, Addie, had COVID, and then about a week or two later, her mom starts noticing some symptoms. You know, she was going through diapers really fast. She was losing weight. They weren't really sure what was going on. They thought at first, you know, maybe it's, you know, a urinary tract infection. They thought maybe it's a growth spurt. You know, there are all these kind of like, we just don't know. These symptoms are weird.
Yeah.
And they didn't match up with the symptoms that she'd had with COVID. You know, Addie had a cough, but it wasn't a severe case of COVID either. And they take her to her pediatrician's office, and her blood sugar is at 350 milligrams per deciliter, which is really high. And then they go to the ER from there, and it's at 550. For her age, for a two-year-old, the highest should be about 180. So really, really high blood sugar. And yeah, she was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes from there, which, you know, kind of explained her symptoms, but she wasn't born with the disease. So it's this kind of strange case. And now she has type 1 diabetes for life.
And I mean, that's just amazing. And they don't really understand the mechanism that's making this happen. The CDC is, I mean, Addie, I think, is maybe one of the people who is part of this study. I'm not positive, but the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is now studying this and why it might be happening.
That's right. Yeah, they put out a study that talked about the connection. And then Primary Children's Hospital is kind of tracking, you know, the number of cases that they have as part of a national study, too. So, you know, doctors are looking into this, but I mean, it's true to say that it's really kind of a medical mystery right now.
Yeah. There's another story that you have of a six-year-old, Lisa, who is yet another person who had this happen after getting COVID, right?
That's right. Yeah. Lisa's 6 years old. In her case, it came, if I'm remembering right, a month or two after she had COVID. She kind of had similar symptoms as Addie. You know, she was like going through several pull-ups. One thing that was kind of interesting that her parents noted was that her breath kind of smelled like really sweet, like she'd eaten a lot of candy, but she was also losing weight. And her mom is actually a nurse practitioner, and it didn't really occur to her, you know, what was happening either, because it's such a strange, you know, response to a virus. And so, again, they took her into, you know, a pediatrician's office, and her blood sugar is just super high. And, you know, it's interesting, too. The doctors are saying that not only are kids presenting with diabetes, but they're presenting with severe diabetes really quickly, which is really dangerous. I mean, you can go into diabetic ketoacidosis and honestly go into a coma. I mean, these are very severe cases. This is very high blood sugar levels.
Wow. Courtney, I mean, again, this can come after a very mild case of COVID for these kids. And so I guess something that I should ask you is, what should parents be on the lookout in terms of, you know, what kind of symptoms should they be looking for in terms of making certain that they are aware of what those symptoms are in case this is happening to their child?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that. Both the parents in this case, you know, also warn other parents, and the doctors are also warning parents to watch for this. So, you know, after your kid has COVID, these symptoms can appear within a week or even a month, but frequent urination, increased thirst, increased hunger, noticeably losing weight without trying to, blurry vision, you know, numbness of your hands or feet, being excessively tired, dry skin. And then additionally, with type 1 diabetes, you can have vomiting, nausea, and stomach pains. So kind of a variety of symptoms, but really the ones that appeared in these kids that we talked to were the frequent urination and the increased thirst and the weight loss. And those are, generally speaking, kind of the first things that would appear in a case.
Right. And again, lifelong disease as a result of their experience. Is there any, I mean, obviously we want to avoid getting COVID-19 is sort of the answer here. But on the preventative side, for those who are impacted, it's just so difficult. And of course, it's very difficult right now to avoid COVID because it seems to be everywhere. Courtney, we could go much deeper on this and on all of your reporting, actually, but we are saving time for a couple of recorded segments. And so we will have to leave it there. My apologies for that. But we will turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Courtney, since I'm cutting you off, I'll give you first dibs. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Oh, I love being first. I will pick Colby Peterson's really fascinating story about Copperhive Vintage. It's this vintage store that was kind of forced to move out of the way for luxury apartments to be built. And her shop was demolished and she was really surprised. And now her shop where she's moved to is not doing so well. So, you know, kind of along with Tony's story, just kind of the impacts of growth and development in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, it seemed to fit specifically into the story that that Tony highlighted earlier. And so thanks for that pick, Courtney Tanner, for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Tony Semerad, we will turn to you. And what do you got?
So my Underplayed Story comes from what I think is the biggest story of the week, and that is the James Webb Telescope's Space Telescope images,
yeah,
which are a breathtaking human achievement. And I can't wait to see what this instrument yields in the future. And the underplayed part of it is Utah's role. There were, you know, scientists up at Utah State University and people out in Magna for, you know, what orbital ATK, and right, even some beryllium in the mirrors was mined in Juab County. So Utah's played a role here, and I think, you know, enjoys some of that achievement, you know.
Utah's role in our being able to peer back in time and deeper into space than we ever have before. That's a great pick, Tony. I love it. And those images are just astounding, and there's so much more. I'm actually going to recommend that listeners go and find NASA's high-resolution images of what they've released so far from the telescope, because you can zoom in and just kind of get lost in it. It's really neat. Tony, thanks for that. For my part, I got to go with a story that's by Blake Apgar, Robert Gerke, and Connor Sanders. And it is about a story that this is from yesterday, that is in some ways inscrutable, not because of their reporting, but because there are these details that we don't seem to have. And it's that the Salt Lake City Board of Education has placed the district's first Black superintendent on leave without giving any sort of public explanation. And the story that Blake, Robert, and Connor wrote was about Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall calling for an open and honest process going forward with that story that we still don't really understand. That's my pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Tony Semerad and Courtney Tanner, both with Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Thanks, Roger.
Yeah, of course. We're going to take a quick break in the show, and then when we come back, we will turn to a couple of recorded segments. Stay with us. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and this is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up. Right now on the show, we are going to turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Becky Jacobs about where things stand when it comes to the law on abortion in the state of Utah. Take a listen. Becky Jacobs, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, thanks for making time for this. We really appreciate it, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, Becky, after the Supreme Court decision sending lawmaking on abortion back to the states, Utah's trigger law, the law that bans most abortions except in special circumstances, that was put on hold. The latest is that it's been put further on hold. Can you explain to us, you know, where we are in the legal process again?
Yeah, that's right. At the end of June, the trigger law went into effect, and that was given a temporary restraining order, which basically put it on hold for a couple of weeks. So in this meantime, there's an 18-week ban in effect in Utah. So that's the law right now. And earlier this week, there was a hearing about the trigger law again for a request from Planned Parenthood Association of Utah, basically asking that this law continue to be put on hold and not be enforced until their lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the law is resolved. And after the state and Planned Parenthood's lawyers made their arguments, a judge decided to side with Planned Parenthood and granted that request for that preliminary injunction. So as you said, it will stay on hold for now.
Okay. For now, I guess in terms of timing of this, do we have an expectation of how long abortion will be legal, at least, you know, up until 18 weeks here in Utah? Is there sort of in terms of how long this preliminary injunction will be playing out?
Yeah, I asked Carrie Galloway, who's the CEO of Planned Parenthood in Utah, what she expects. And she thinks this lawsuit is going to go on for at least a year. So it's going to be a more lengthy process now, but we know that the state is very likely to appeal this. And so it's a question of how long that will take, but at least there shouldn't be lots of changes in the law almost every day like we've seen the last couple weeks.
Yeah, maybe we should actually talk about the sort of where things stood, like where the law was on abortion versus where it is now, because it wasn't that there was an 18-week ban in place before Roe was overturned, well, before the decision came down overturning Roe. It's that this 18-week ban is kind of newly implemented as well after previous lawsuits. I guess what I'm asking is, Becky, will the 18-week ban that's currently the law of the land be challenged in court as well?
Right. A little background, the 18-week ban was passed by the legislature in 2019, and that was put on hold because Planned Parenthood sued then. And so that had been on hold until the Roe decision came down, or really the Supreme Court ruling in Dobbs is what the case was. And so that allowed this 18-week ban to go into effect. And I asked Carrie Galloway again of Planned Parenthood if they plan to challenge the 18-week ban again now in addition to the trigger law. And she said there's no plans for that right now. Their full focus is on this trigger law.
Okay. Interesting. You know, your article on this, on the judge's decision to issue this preliminary injunction. Sorry, I can't think of the wording for it.
Yeah,
it features the stories of three women who are seeking an abortion, or maybe who were seeking an abortion. I don't know the timing on this, but Planned Parenthood highlighted their stories in their court filings as they sought that preliminary injunction against the trigger law. One woman from Salt Lake County, one woman from Weber County, one from Sevier County. They all used pseudonyms in this filing. And can you tell us a little of their stories and why each of them was seeking an abortion? I mean, if the trigger law had gone into effect, obviously they would have had to have left the state to get an abortion. What were they saying in these filings?
Yeah, Planned Parenthood filed these statements from these three anonymous Utahns the day before the hearing on Monday. And basically it was to say, these people are the ones that will be seeking abortions in Utah this week, and they will be affected if this trigger law goes into effect. And so they really described their situations of not being able to support another child, or that they're worried about complications. You know, everyone has their own experiences with this. And so one thing they also wanted to point out is the state had kind of questioned, you know, shouldn't it be these people who are bringing the lawsuit? And Planned Parenthood was trying to show that they're bringing it on behalf of these people who said that they wouldn't have the time or the money or the energy to have brought these lawsuits themselves. And so they really wanted to capture who was affected.
Yeah. I mean, there were interesting stories. One, as you said, worried about medical complications, because that was something that they had been worried about or had experienced before. Another pretty young person who was, you know, wanted to pursue educational opportunities, didn't think that their ex-boyfriend and themselves should be put in this position, especially given their relationship status and so on. It's a really interesting read, and I encourage listeners to go check it out. The judge in this case, Becky, he talked about the legal nuance involved and about, I guess, about why he was issuing the preliminary injunction. Can you tell us just a little bit about what this is Judge Stone, I can't think of his first name right now, a little bit about what he said in his ruling and sort of the rationale he gave for instituting this preliminary injunction?
Yeah, this is Third District Judge Andrew Stone. And he really got into, this is complicated, and there's so many questions here that are going to need to be addressed and dug into. And he basically said, you know, this case is going to be appealed. It's going to go up to the Utah Supreme Court, and that's who should decide this. But he was really talking about, he knows there are strong feelings in this, but when you're going to make such a drastic change as this is to women's health care that they've had for nearly 50 years in Utah, that we need to watch what's happening before it. And so part of the preliminary injunction was determining if there's irreparable harm that'll be done. And he said he thought that there would be, of women delaying treatment or resorting to other methods if they couldn't get an abortion. He just goes into it more, but there's just lots of constitutional issues here. And really it comes down to the state and Planned Parenthood disagreeing, does this trigger law violate the Utah Constitution or not?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just I think it's interesting because it is, you know, lots of constitutional issues, but what we're talking about here is state constitutional issues. I think a lot of people listening will hear this and think, well, no, the constitutional issue has been resolved by the Supreme Court.
Right.
But what that did is send it back to the states. And the question is, how does the trigger law jive, I guess, with the state's constitution?
That's exactly it. And so Planned Parenthood's arguing that there's a handful of rights in the state constitution that this would violate. And the state points out, you know, the word abortion is not in our state constitution, so there's not an explicit right to it. And they argue there's not an implied right either. And so we're going to see these arguments continue to be fleshed out and really explored to see what's going to happen with this trigger law.
Wow. Becky, I want just to talk about some other related reporting that you did this week. And that is, if and when this trigger law does go into effect, how would that impact access to things like abortion pills? You explored this in an article for the Tribune, and maybe first you can talk about what medical abortion is, what these pills are, and how and when they are used.
Yeah. So a medication abortion involves two drugs, and it's typically used earlier in pregnancy. So up until about 11 weeks. So with this 18-week ban, that's not affecting this. And so the trigger ban, though, would ban most abortions except for those few limited circumstances. So that would affect these earlier abortions with medication and later where it's more the in-clinic procedure abortions. And so we really thought that there were going to be questions people were going to have, not just in Utah, but other states imposing abortion restrictions too. You know, could you get abortion pills by mail or through a telehealth visit with a doctor in another state? And how does that affect emergency contraception? So that's really what we tried to do in this article.
Yeah. And I guess maybe we can talk about what would happen, because the trigger law, what it does is it regulates physicians, right? Not individuals. And that kind of plays into how this might play out in terms of how the law is adhered to or how the law applies, I guess, in the state of Utah. Can you kind of walk us through that, Becky? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's really key. That is an important thing to know, is the trigger law focuses on physicians and providers of abortions. It's not so much, you know, on the women and the people receiving them. And so the short answer of this article is it's a complicated topic and it's not totally clear. And these are things that are going to need to be explored more. But a University of Utah expert walked us through this. And really, the key thing is to look at the definitions in the trigger law of a definition of an abortion and a physician. And really, it comes down to whether the physician is licensed in the state of Utah or not. So for instance, if you were to go to Nevada and get the abortion pill from a doctor who's not licensed in Utah and bring it back and take it, that's not technically an abortion under the literal language of the statute. And so that's where it gets really tricky. But if you're reading it just literally how it is, that's the answer that expert found.
That, of course, ultimately, it could change, right? I mean, if the law changes, it wouldn't take much for a state lawmaker to amend the law, correct, to address that?
Sure. And I think it's very reasonable to expect we're going to see abortion legislation this next session. We're already seeing people propose it. And we've seen other states take other approaches. So I think this is a very much evolving situation.
Yeah. I mean, one that I still wonder about, and maybe it doesn't really matter while this preliminary injunction is in place, is whether or not somebody might try to run legislation to prevent people from traveling to go and get an abortion.
And that's what some other states have tried. And we don't know the legality of that yet. And so that's going to be something interesting that the Leslie Francis from the U who spoke with us pointed out, you know, Connecticut's passing legislation to try to protect their physicians from other states. And so she came up with a scenario. And so it's really going to be interesting to see what each state does. And, you know, one thing that also happened was Montana was seen as a place that maybe would be a place for people in surrounding states to go to. But then they said that they weren't going to take out of state patients. And so we're watching how each state is reacting and changing every day right now.
Wow. What about emergency contraception and how it might be impacted by the trigger law?
Right. So the morning after pill, which is like Plan B or Ella, that's not medication abortion. That's emergency contraception, and that's preventing a pregnancy. It doesn't affect whether you're pregnant or not if you already are. So the short answer is the trigger law does not affect emergency contraception.
Okay. Well, it's really interesting reporting, and I guess there's more obviously to learn, and there will be more to come in the coming months and years on this. Becky Jacobs is a reporter with Salt Lake Tribune. And as always, Becky, really appreciate your filling us in on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. And again, that is the Tribune's Becky Jacobs. You can find her reporting at sltrib.com. You're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Now on the show, we're going to turn to my conversation with the Trib's latest, with the Tribune's Utah Eats reporter, Stephanie Russell, on the latest in Utah food and alcohol news. Take a listen. Stephanie Russell, Utah Eats reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've been writing about the Utah food scene for the Tribune for a little while now, and I've been meaning to get you in to talk about some of the changes that we've been seeing and actually about some of the specific businesses that you've written about. But before we dive into the food world, I'm wondering if we can just talk a little bit about the world of drink. And one piece of recent news, the regulatory board that controls alcohol in Utah has a new name. And maybe you could just tell us what that's about. Why is there a new name? How did that happen, and why, Stephanie?
Yeah, so Tiffany Klassen, who's the head of the commission, the DABS now, the Division of Alcohol and Beverage Services. I think I got that right. And prior to that, it was the Division of Alcoholic Beverage Control.
Yeah.
So this is like a whole new roadmap for what they're doing. Like Tiffany's very much about being transparent with bars and restaurants and the public. And so the last letter is where everything lives. So it goes from control to service. So it's less this we must control what people are drinking to let's have a relationship and talk through this and be more transparent and progressive about things, if that makes sense. And there's some specifics I can touch on with that.
Well, I wonder, that's the question I have, is does the change from control to services mean anything when it comes to, say, licensing of restaurants or of bars and taverns, et cetera, the liquor licensing process? Is that part of it? Or is, you know, from control to services, does the focus on services change anything in that avenue?
Well, their hands are sort of tied because everything happens up in the ledge.
Yeah.
So until something shifts in a major way up there, they're sort of stuck with what they have. And so I think they're doing their best to be transparent and let people know what they're doing so that people understand a bit better, you know, what the process is, what the laws are. They're trying really hard to make sure bars and restaurants, I didn't include this in my last little update because I go the last Tuesday of every month, I motor out to Taylorsville and I sit in a room with lots of other people for anywhere from an hour to 3 hours, and I watched the whole thing play out.
Yeah.
So Chili's, the chain, they have an employee handbook that they just disseminate to everybody, right?
Yeah.
But it did not have proper training for their people for Utah because things are so weird here in terms of alcohol law. So they were getting dinged left and right because their people weren't trained. I mean, they were like slinging cocktails the way they would in California, and that doesn't work in Utah. So I know the commission is working with Chili's to be like, hey, wow, rewrite your manual because this doesn't work here. And they have done that.
And it's a little bit different than just like shutting them down immediately. Oh, you said that their hands were tied, I remember, on the licensing part by the legislature, meaning mm-hmm. the state legislature. And that's because the licensing, meaning how many licenses are granted, is based on a certain calculus. Can you tell us about
that?
Yes. Yeah.
It's all about how many people live in Utah. And of course, people are pouring in here. So pretty soon we'll have lots of liquor licenses, right?
Right.
Because our population is exploding. But yeah, it's a ratio. I mean, math is kind of my kryptonite. I think it's X number per 10,000 people. And I can't recall that number. But sometimes licenses will free up for other weird reasons. Like there was a change in resort licenses. They just got this huge windfall of like 10 and a half licenses, which was like huge for Utah. And they doled out a lot of those last month, but that was due to a change in the legislature in how they handle resort licenses. And there was a bar that burned down and they are not going to be back up and running anytime soon. So they surrendered their license. So there's another one. Hmm. Or somebody goes out of business and there's another one. So they do free up here and there. They can't buy licenses from each other anymore, which is huge.
Wow.
That was how a lot of new businesses got their licenses prior to this year, and they would pay, I mean, I heard figures like $50,000.
Wow.
So now you can't,
wow, they can't buy licenses between each other. So they just, it gets like reverted to the state and then the state mm-hmm. doles it out again. Huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Intriguing. You know, well, I don't know, the Barapalooza thing, I was curious. I mean, you talked about that, how many licenses were,
yes.
were done in one day. This is the last meeting you attended.
Yes.
They gave out a fair amount.
8.5, I believe.
Wow.
May have been 8. And really, all that did was cut down the queue because all of the meetings I've attended, there are 16 bars on the agenda and one or one and a half license. It sounds kind of funny. It's a seasonal license. It's for Park City, basically, because you have businesses that operate during the ski season or in the summer when people want to go mountain biking, and they're closed. They're only open seasonally, so they have half a bar license. So it may have been 8.5, but really all it did was cut the queue down, because you every month you have this competition where there's one bar license and 16 different businesses, and
wow.
You know, it's and they have pre-meetings, what the commissioners do. They have a little subgroup where they look at everything with a fine-tooth comb. And they, you know, I imagine they probably have a running pro and con list for every business. And then in the meeting, people get up and sort of give their testimony. Like, this is why it's got almost like a reality show flavor to
sure.
it.
Sure. Shark Tank or whatever.
Yeah, it's like the state government version of Shark Tank a bit.
Wild, and people's business plans are riding on that. That's really interesting. And then you have to wait until there are enough licenses to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Are there new licenses, new bars or taverns or whatever coming online in Utah that you are particularly excited about? Are you actually allowed to even talk that way about being excited about specific places?
I suppose I can say I'm excited about the news that this thing is happening.
Yeah.
I mean, just off the top of my head, I was very happy to see that there are, and this is going to sound funny, but more sober bars opening up, because I feel like, it's not just because it's Utah, it just gives people another way to socialize without doing damage to their liver cells. Just gives people another, because not everyone drinks coffee, and that whole culture is very interesting. It's not just teetotaling.
Yeah.
They actually have some pretty sophisticated ideas about mixing different flavors.
Yeah.
And, it's more like a foodie thing. It's not just about abstaining. It's like its own little world. And it's really gaining steam. I mean, there was a sober bar. Well, I shouldn't say sober bar. I misspoke there. Sober bars are for folks who are in recovery.
Okay.
This is, I think, the preferred term for these.
Dry.
Dry or non-alcoholic or alcohol-free or, yeah.
Yeah. And that's cool. That's a really interesting avenue, and we'll have to check out places like that. I do want to get into the world of food, and so I'm wondering if I might ask you the same question about things that are new and interesting from a perspective of someone who covers this that are coming online in the world of food. Maybe we can actually dive right here into your reporting on this place called Dough Miner. What is this? It's sort of an old Utah connection, a new Utah business.
So it's cool. So there's a thing called a pasty, which is a hand pie. It's generally savory. And the story is they originated in the UK, Cornwall. Miners ate them. Mm. And basically what the idea was is that it would stay warm for a long time. So he could just, and they were, not to be genderous, but 19th century Cornwall, I don't think you had a lot of lady miners. But he tucked it in his pocket. It would stay warm all day. And then there was this crust that he could use almost like a handle, because they had like arsenic and tin and all kinds of toxic metals on their hands.
Wow.
So they'd eat the pie and then they'd throw the crust down the mine shaft for this little mythical creature called a Tommyknocker, sort of like a gnome or something.
Yeah.
And the legend is that they would like tap on the walls when there was going to be a mine collapse. And
So you're making kind of an offering to them so that they'll
warn
you.
An offering to them. Yeah, they're like a little mind spirit or something. So
these are hand pies, like meat pies?
There's meat pies. Yeah, they have a salmon one. The traditional one in Cornwall, it's beef, potatoes, rutabaga, and carrots, I believe. And they taste tested the rutabaga, and nobody was terribly excited about eating rutabaga. Like in Utah, it's like, but their idea, so there were miners in Park City who, I mean, Pasties made a stop here through the Park City mines.
I'll say, I'm just going to interject for a quick second, that I grew up eating these. My dad made Cornish pasties since for as long as I can remember.
Oh my gosh.
And his granddad worked in the Ontario mine in Park City, and mm-hmm. they had in the Ontario mine a Cornish pump to pump out all the water that was collecting in the mine shaft. So, I mean, Cornish pumps, Cornish pasties, maybe there's a connection there.
There might be, yeah. Well, they disappeared for some reason. Like, if you go up to Michigan, they're everywhere.
Right. Yeah, UP.
If you go to Montana, they're everywhere. Somehow they just never got a foothold here. They disappeared when the miners left.
Yeah.
They took their pasties with them. And there was a British pub in Trolley Square that served them for a little while, but no one knows what they are here. But yeah. Now we have them again.
Where is a Dough Miner?
It's in Maven West. It's right across from TF Brewing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stephanie, we're getting low on time here. I had meant to ask you about more things, including this food truck face-off that's happening at Liberty Park
this weekend
on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Maybe, yeah, just can you give us just the basics on that score? When and where and who, and we'll leave out the why.
Yeah, it's at Liberty Park in like from 4 to 7, I believe.
Okay.
And it's almost 30 trucks. They've done it for several years, and there's three local nonprofits. They change nonprofits every year, and it goes to charity, and it's a really diverse collection of food trucks. I talked to Umani Pizza, and they're kind of cool because they actually have an imported Italian pizza oven in their truck, which I thought, oh my gosh, these guys are
serious
super people to be sitting in that truck with that oven. But they said it's not that bad.
Oh yeah, so the heat. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
It's a black shipping container with an oven in it.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, you guys are like.
And they specialize in Roman style pizza.
Roman square. Yeah, well, actually, it's rectangular pizza with a slightly different texture of crust.
Cool. Stephanie Russell, I'm sorry to cut you off short, but I am so grateful for you making time for doing this, and I hope to have you on the show again soon. Stephanie Russell is Utah Eats reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we are out of time. That's it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org. That's also where you can stream our live programming as well. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.